We'll send the Education Committee order, please. Today is Thursday, April 25th, 2019. The time is 9:03 a.m. In attendance are Senator Birch, Senator Hughes, Senator Costello. I assume Senator Begich will be along shortly, and myself, Senator Stevens. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today we're going to take up Senate Bill 114 referred to as the Education Transformation Act. Any questions or comments before we begin? Okay, well, thank you all. We'll go to some opening comments then. It's intention to have a committee discussion on this bill hold it for work during the interim and probably work with the House Education Committee as well. And Tim Lamkin is here to go through the bill through a sectional. Tim. Tim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lamkin, staff to Senator Stevens and the Education Committee. Before you is Senate Bill 114, Version A. This is literally a merger of Senate Bill, at this time, it's literally a merger of Senate Bill 30, which is the Middle Colleges Bill that was passed from this committee earlier this session. Also, Senate Bill 53, which regards University of Alaska accreditation reporting, which was also passed from this committee earlier this session. And Senate Bill 79, which we had a CS version S that was published on April 12th, but it was not adopted by this committee. So that CS is rolled into this bill, and that's what, per the chair's request, what we focus on today is to go through the changes of 79, and I'll kind of glaze over the Senate Bill 30, 53 components as we go through the bill. Okay, so beginning with section one and 79, the first thing to reference was all intent language was struck from 79. That was recommendation and thinking from legal that intent language is nice and we can read it into the record to make that clear if someone wants to look that up later, but it has no effect of law. And so for purposes of keeping the bill shorter and less bulky, we took out intent language. Section 3 has to do with staff and student ratios. There was a slight change in this language to specify, first of all, the intent of that section is to every year have an annual report published by school districts of their student-teacher ratios, student-administrator ratios, teacher-administrator ratios. And the catch there was to help define what we're talking about when we are referring to administrators and teachers. And so section three, section three is not about that. Section three is about extracurricular activities. That's the original from Senate Bill 79, recognizing credit when students challenge math and art, English and so forth, that it includes that also. So career and tech education, physical ed, music and art, and other cultural activities outside of school hours so that they could receive credit for that toward their graduation. That's section three. Section four is the change as regards student-teacher ratios. And so we added the phrase classroom teacher there and provided a definition of that, which is consistent with existing regulation and the norms that they use in contracts and so forth when we're talking about classroom teachers. That's section four. Section five is the definitions of those. They're linked together with the classroom teachers. Section six regards Senate Bill 30, the middle college activity and annual reporting. Section seven has to do with cooperative arrangement grants, and this is a change from 79, and those, of course, have to do when districts collaborate with other districts to find administrative and other educational services cost savings that the deed award a grant to them when those savings are realized. And currently the cap on that grant is $100,000. Senate Bill 79, the change increased that cap to 2,000, and that, I have to admit, was talked about, but it was a miscommunication with legal. That was not outright intended to be increased in that cap, but it is something negotiable, of course, with the committee.
So 100,000 to 200,000.
Correct.
All right.
Mr.
Yes.
Please. I just make a comment about that. Actually, that was from 2 years ago in SB 96, which was essentially 79. And we had spoken about we didn't necessarily want to trigger a higher fiscal note. And this actually has not been funded recently, but it would give the option to, you know, if the Finance Committee chose to fund it. But we had talked about not raising it, but, you know, so that can be something the committee decides whether we should leave it at 200 or put it at 100. It's not forcing these grants to go out. Of course, it would have to be funded. The intent more is to encourage and provide incentives for districts to cooperate, perhaps share finance directors, perhaps share superintendents. And then, and Tim will probably talk about in the next section how it involves, I believe, if there's a cooperative arrangement, has to include at least one rural district. So the idea is to help with the, we have a lot of school districts in our state. Right. To try to streamline. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Tim?
So continuing to wrap up with Section 7 there, another important policy change there includes that it's been amended to historically and currently the CAGs, the cooperative arrangement grants, are between school district and a school district. The new language here would open that up to not only be between districts, but also between districts and businesses, nonprofits, and other state agencies, which is an important distinction to mention there. So then that segues into Section 8, which really speaks to the notion of finding opportunities to pool health insurance policies, and in particular giving districts the option to pool their district employees with the state insurance pool, and that these cooperative arrangement grants could include that transition. And it's important to just also make the distinction that they would recognize the grants for making that transition, the cost savings of making the change, but not to pay the premiums to participate in that insurance policy.
Yes, Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding insurance, what are the disclosure requirements, if any, that we have for, kind of insurance, the number of claimants, the amount of claim, the solvency, is that a requirement that we have today?
Mr. Chair, Senator Birch, thank you for that very good and technical question. I did not come prepared to answer that today, but I will take note of it, and we'll come back to that if you don't mind. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks, Senator Birch.
Okay, so Section 9 is regarding school districts' unreserved fund balances. The original 79 had that increased the cap to 25%. The CS, and in discussion with committee members individually, the new bill here increases that cap to 15%. This is a sophisticated subject matter. I have on record on file here that if you haven't received it from them directly, I would be happy to share an interesting read published by the Alaska Association of School Business Officials, a white paper published on April 1st, which gives a good summary of the purpose of account balances, and I'll summarize further that the way they're crafted locally is that they serve and represent a common accounting practice that provides for some flexibility in school districts' cash flow when it comes to paying vendors on time. Also, as they have receivables that vary, whereas the state revenues that they receive might be discharged or dispersed on a monthly basis, federal dollars such as Title I don't come in quite as regularly. And so that the account, unreserved account balances help give them that cash flow to make those adjustments. It's also for contingency spending. If they have a spike in energy costs, if there's an earthquake or those types of things, it really serves as an emergency fund. I think you may have heard of it referred to that before. It's also my understanding that very few districts actually hit the 10% cap as it's currently in statute. Another important fact is that these account fund balances aren't necessarily transferable between districts. And so it really serves as, it's my impression at least, is not that they are not a slush fund, and that it may be the recommendation that we keep that at 10%. But that is something that's an important policy thing to be discussed by the committee.
Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had some discussion with some that say when you have an account balance that, and you go into labor negotiations with the bargaining units that are represented in that district, that basically that cash balance, that fund balance, is fully accessible as far as from any labor negotiation standpoint. In other words, you can't just say, and I guess I would be interested in how accessible that fund balance is, because I know there's been discussion about, what it's needed for and for unforeseen circumstances, but if it's I'm just curious as to how maybe if you could do some research in the interim here on arbitrators' decisions on accessing a what could potentially be a very significant account balance in some cases. If you look at 10% of what we spend a year on education, that's a pretty significant number. So as long as we're identifying issues that we might want to follow up on, that would be one I would be interested in, is how that weighs in the labor negotiations aspects.
I think it would be good to have the fiscal officers come to us this interim and talk to us about it. And do they have a recommendation at the end of that white paper, or what do the fiscal officers have to say?
There was no outright recommendation that I gleaned from it, other than suggesting that the rhetoric or the communication from the administration wasn't entirely accurate as to how the fund balances are used and how available that money is to spend. To address the comment by Senator Birch, the preliminary research I've done suggests that they are certainly not slush funds. That it is, they do generally have fairly stringent restrictions placed on them for specific purposes, to include cash flow flexibility, paying vendors, paying costs when they are presented to them, and emergency purposes, something that comes at them that they didn't expect.
Well, that's good. So we've got a couple people. Maybe if you could finish Senator Birch, and we'll go to Senator Costello and Senator Hughes.
Just for a clarity point, I guess the question would be, can arbitrator's decision in a labor contract negotiations provide access to that account balance?
Got it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you putting together this larger bill for us to consider some of these issues. But I do believe that the fund balance topic needs to be really examined, because my discussions also with the districts indicate that they have requirements that they must have a certain balance on hand. And so I think, with no disrespect to the legislature, I think we're a little ignorant on this topic in terms of that pot of money, and it's not just sitting there without some requirements or thoughts as to why the amount is what it is. And so I am encouraged by your comments that we really look into it, and perhaps we survey the districts or at least have them present so that we understand better why they keep these fund balances and what requirements they have on them, and to really get at the truth about why we have the amounts, we see those amounts, because we see them and we think, oh, they haven't spent them, or then the negotiation process comes along and you wonder if it's there, for certain purposes. So I appreciate your interest in really looking into this more closely.
Thank you. Well, good discussion. We'll make sure we do that this interim. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in a conversation with Mark Foster, who's provided, he spoke with us yesterday, he said the national standard is above 10%, but he wasn't sure what it was. So I would say that would be something. We should find out what the national standard is for school districts. And when you think of the private sector, there's typically best practice standards as far as how much payroll should be on hand and that kind of thing. So one of the things by having this in, whether we resolve it or not, if this were to move forward to the Senate Finance Committee, because it's been a topic of discussion this year, I think it allows them to consider it, too, whether it's appropriate or should be dropped back down to 10%. But by having it in the bill, it does highlight it and might clear up some of the misunderstanding. As Senator Costello explained, we might not have the knowledge of what the requirements are. So, but I think an interim project would be fine. Is there a national standard? And find out from our districts, too, what the various requirements. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Very good discussion, and we'll make sure we get into that. Please go ahead, Tim.
Continuing then with Section 10 of Senate Bill 114, this is what I refer to as the praxis section. This was largely rewritten from original Senate Bill 79 at the request and substantial input from the department. That section was rewritten to describe a regimented process for the State Board of Education Early Development to evaluate and adjust the minimum passing scores on required competency exams for persons to qualify for their teacher certification. If you want to go into detail on that, we can, but that's the summary of what that section does.
Okay, thank you. Senator Costello.
Thank you for working with the department on this. I had some concerns about how that language was addressed in the previous version, but I understand this is longer discussion. I just want to throw out there that I think there's an assumption that's inherent in this particular section that higher passing scores on competency exams result in better results in the classroom, and that might be something that you would just assume, but I actually would be interested in looking at states that get good results with their students and then looking at what type of standard they have for their teachers. I just want to throw that out there because I think with all of these, there are certain assumptions that we're just making without really addressing that. And so I'm all for increasing the competency of teachers, but I don't necessarily know if content knowledge is what results in better classroom teachers. I think there's a lot more to it. And I also think that the mentoring possibility is very important when you have new teachers, and a new teacher isn't necessarily an inexperienced or a teacher that doesn't have a lot of value. I mean, just because somebody is new 1 or 2 years, they could be a master teacher. I mean, I've seen principals discuss teachers as master teachers in those initial years. They bring a different type of energy that to the classroom. So I just want to throw that out there, that I'd be very interested in looking at when you talk about student results, because that's what we're looking at here, is the results of our students. When you back that into the requirements for the teachers, what are those other states and countries require?
Mr. Chair.
Very good point, yes. Thank you. Senator Hughes.
And I agree with Senator Costello. This is just a very sliver, and it's not actually an indicator of how effective. It's just you, particularly at the high school level, you want to make sure teachers have the content knowledge, particularly if a student, for instance, in physics, I believe physics was one of the examples where our requirement was much less than other states, 25 points or something. And, if the student's really thinking about going into that in college, we want to make sure they're prepared. So that was more of the thinking. But I did have a good conversation with the commissioner, and at some point he might want to share with us, because they're looking at a more comprehensive approach because they realize this is just a sliver. And they may have something ready to bring forward to us that we might even be able to incorporate at some point, Mr. Chair, as far as a way to help ensure that our teachers are ready and more effective, so not just the content testing.
Very good.
If I might add, Mr. Chairman, anecdotally, and research and exposures I've had to teachers, it's been other comments I've heard from in the past that the praxis exam itself is perhaps singularly the most difficult and or stressful, intimidating process of for a teacher to receive their teacher certification. And also in the context of our hearing yesterday with Mr. Mark Foster regarding student success in life, one of his points, as you may recall, was that his data seemed to indicate that student success in life was not necessarily driven by high test scores. And so we could hypothesize that the same could apply for teachers. Having a strong score on a praxis exam doesn't necessarily make them automatically a great teacher. In fact, there may be instances where they might score poorly but are yet a stellar teacher. But that being said, that it is certainly a process and a fine line to be drawn.
And I just want to mention, I know Deed's here, and I don't know if you want to take the time, but part of what they explained when they brought this language forward was that it will sometimes you can have a fluke of a score where they'll redo the test, and nationally there'll be just not as many people passing that normally would, and they realize there was a problem with the test. And so this gives a flexibility for the department to make adjustments. So I just thought I'd throw that in.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. We'll work with the department on this issue as well. Tim.
Okay, so moving on to Section 11 and 12, this is consistent with the original version of Senate Bill 79. Whereas the Department of Education and the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, the PTPC, will share administrative support services to reduce the costs of the PTPC. Section 13 on pages 7 and 8 is a new section. This is the meat and potatoes, if you will, big component of 79. This is the Virtual Education Consortium section. It was significantly rewritten and consolidated to maximize the flexibility for the Department of Education and school districts to develop the program. The significant changes in that section there include that it was first of all expanded to include online learning resources for any grade, not just 6 through 12. It includes resources for both students and teachers, including the professional development resources and other training for online virtual course delivery. That is, say, you know, training teachers to provide the online courses. And then the third significant change there was the fee structure, that the department may charge districts rather than shall by regulation for those districts that choose to participate and draw on the resources of the consortium, limited to a prorated amount. The way it was originally worded, it seemed to needed some clarity that a district wouldn't be charged exorbitantly for participating, that it would be prorated relative to the costs associated with maintaining that consortium database. We can go into detail if you wish, Mr. Chairman, but that's a summary of the changes in Section 13.
Thank you, Tim. It's a very important section. This last Easter, when I was home, I found out my five-year-old granddaughter, who is learning to read, is going to be taking a summer online class through the university to make sure that her reading skills don't drop off. This is my psychologist's daughter who knows everything, but so I think that's really remarkable that that's not something that we thought of when our children were growing up, but so continue to make sure kids don't backslide during the summer, Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I had a long conversation with Posey Boggs, a well-known name, regarding reading, and I believe taking out the grade 6 to 12, initially I don't like the idea of a child being in front of a screen. But she actually said there's some, particularly in a very small school, limited resources, that if a child were struggling with reading, there's some excellent online types of games and fun things that can really help a young child. And so I think taking out the grades. One thing I had a question, Tim, the earlier, the original bill, the SB 79 anyway, had a way where districts could charge for courses they were offering. Here we have something where the consortium may charge a fee for districts participating. Will this prevent a district from charging? So if a school in Anchorage, for instance, has some open slots and four students from another district take it, is there a way for that district to charge the other district they're providing the service to?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, at this time, that was not the intent of the current CS. That is something that would be addressed and defined if it's not in the statute. If it's not made clear in the statute, it would be set up through regulation as a result of the work of the task force that's coming up later in the bill to set up the virtual consortium.
Follow up.
Please.
That's excellent. I just want to make sure there's just not anything in here that would prevent them from setting that up by regulations. And you're confident that it could be done by regulations?
That's correct. Okay. Certainly the intent of the new language is to provide to maximize the flexibility between the departments and school districts to make the program work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Costello.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to point out, I think there's going to be some concern over the section that allows the consortium to require districts to have a shared calendar or bell schedule. I think districts have their hands full right now with their own schedules, and to have a consortium be prioritizing the online learning to disrupt the schedule that they have. I think I'm just pointing that out, that having spent a lot of time in the schools and what have you, I think that that's just something that we'll want to hear from the districts on and see if there's a way, you know, to have this happen without, you know, the force of law, but maybe just more of a cooperative opportunity, you know, because not every school is going to be able to do this. And I think flexibility with the online curriculum is important, but I also feel like there's things happening in the school building with the students that are there that probably should take priority.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. That's a very good point, and I know districts have, every district has a different schedule. Senator Hughes.
And I do believe that's an excellent point. The working group will probably be discussing that, and because it's may require, the consortium may require it, and also there's nothing in the legislation forcing districts to join the consortium. So there's kind of an out on both ends, and then with the working group discussing it. Having a conversation with Deputy Commissioner Van Wy, with a district that did a lot of this, she said it does really become a problem, and so it would be an option. I'm guessing the working group will craft it so it'll be for maybe certain. If you want to go down this path with this group of courses, you're going to have to align your bell schedule, or your students won't be able to participate, and then the district could choose, well, we won't participate then. It just gets pretty complicated, especially at the high school level. But I believe with the mays on both ends, a district may participate and the consortium may require, and the fact that the districts are going to be at the table forming the consortium and giving that input that you talked about, I think that they'll craft what will work for the districts.
Yes, please, Senator Costello.
I just wanted to add for the conversation that oftentimes the reason that students pursue a virtual or online opportunity is because their current schedule in the school day doesn't facilitate them taking the classes that they want. So it's kind of a complex, integrated problem where there's cause and effect happening. And so I just wanted to point that out because it's happening already. You know, what we're talking about is providing a structure to something that's already happening. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Good point. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Tim.
Okay. Section 14 is commonly known as the read by nine section. This is comprehensive language that details ways to identify, intervene, and focus on students struggling with reading, with the goal being to ensure that they are reading at or above grade level by the end of third grade. That's the long and the short of Read by Nine. The draft language that was submitted really went into detail. It was language that was, I looked at the source. It was an outfit in Florida, Excel in Ed, led by Jeb Bush. We took that language and tried to make it fit for Alaska. It is, of course, draft language. One significant component of the Read by Nine section that is not in this bill is a mandatory retention. That is to say, if a student is not at grade level at third grade, that they mandatorily be held back in third grade, with some exceptions. The two exceptions being physical or mental disability or English as a second language. Those are pretty much the only exceptions. That is a policy conversation that needs to take place, whether you choose or prefer to go forward with that. Some would argue hold them in kindergarten, hold them in first grade. The earlier you hold them, the better. Some would argue that this is the glue, that the retention is I think it, as it was phrased to me, is humans respond well to deadlines. And so if this is a deadline, that there would be more motivation to target students and make sure they're ready by the end of third grade. I'm not trying to suggest that you go one way or the other. I'm just offering you some points and counterpoints about that conversation.
Thank you, Tim. A very important issue. Retention, if you retain only at third grade or if you consider it earlier, we need to hear from the experts on that and how best to approach it. It's a one-year retention, though, isn't it? You can't go on to a second-year retention. It's just a one-year, I believe. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. Any comments on that issue? It's going to be a big one. Senator Hughes.
It is a big one, and one of the things, if we were to choose to put some teeth in it by some sort of retention, I would hope that the goal would be that we'd also weave into it the goal that the student would catch up with his or her cohort, and that, for instance, if they happen to not have a problem with math, that they would be able to stay with their class and not be held back in that one. But I do think the readiness at kindergarten is pretty fascinating. We talked about that in the joint committee, which would maybe solve some of the problem. And I know in this one, it's asking the department to have a universal assessment tool to have one that can be applied. And I'm just wondering about that, if there ought to be something like that for kindergarten, whether a child is ready to be moved out of kindergarten or ready to begin kindergarten, as I discussed yesterday.
Thank you.
Thank you. I absolutely support doing everything we can for students to be reading by, you know, at grade level, certainly by nine. But I mean, teachers are professionals, and they know. I mean, they can tell you with very quickly once their classroom is set up which kids are struggling with reading. So I'm just a little concerned that we might impose yet another assessment and another, when I think we already do this. And so another thought is that, you know, we have IEPs, we have response to intervention, and so I just want to make sure that this is something that will work with the educators and the professionals that are already in the classrooms and know which students are struggling. But I'm open to looking at other states and what they've done, and certainly know that retaining a child from advancing in school is up there with loss of a limb and loss of a parent, and right? I mean, it's one of, and that's why it has power, is because people then want to avoid that traumatic experience and they will do everything they can. I like the idea of kind of a SWAT team approach, where once a teacher says, you know, this child needs some assistance, and maybe that's an informal process and not necessarily assessment driven or a report driven, but just they know, to have that child receive some assistance so that they can try to catch up, because it's very difficult to catch a child up, especially too when their peers are already in class and they can see that they're behind, and so they adopt strategies to hide that or keep that. And then, you know, as we all know, if a child doesn't read, their ability to take advantage of their education is seriously truncated because of their inability to read, and then they start dealing with all these strategies to hide the fact that they're not a reader, and so it just is. It's just a very complex problem, and I know we have a lot of experienced educators and reading specialists out there, and I hope, Mr. Chair, that we involve them in the process this interim when we look more closely at this legislation.
Thank you, Senator. So, yeah, I think we need to know what districts are doing in the between school years, between first and second, to make sure that the kids who are a little behind are brought up to speed. And as I said, my granddaughter is doing a class just to make sure that she doesn't lose those reading skills over the summer. So they're really important to get that information. Senator Hughes.
Yes, and I believe it was during the interim, and I'm trying to remember what the topic was, when you convened a joint education meeting, I believe. But the superintendent of Anchorage School District mentioned that they were really moving to that SWAT team approach. And then more recently, Anchorage School Board did make a change in policy along these lines. And it might be interesting to get an update from what their change in policy was. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely geared towards this whole read-by-nine approach and making sure students were proficient by third grade. So that might be really helpful in deciding what to do here.
Very good. Thank you.
Sir, Mr. Chairman, I think we could have a lengthy hearing on each section of this bill on the
I think
policy
we will.
Components. Are we done with read by nine?
I think so. Let's go ahead.
So section 15 and 16 are relating to Senate Bill 30, middle colleges, dual credit. I thought we'd glaze over that. Section 17 and 18 on pages 14 and 15 regarding Senate Bill 53, the reporting requirement for the University of Alaska accreditation. Section 19 is on page 15. That is regarding the virtual education task force / working group that's been discussed. We set that up to be led by the led by the Commissioner of Education and Early Development and comprised of leaders in education tech to assemble a year prior to the effective date and who are charged with developing the initial structure and functionality of the consortium described in Section 12. And then in wrap-up, we have the effective dates. They're in Sections 20 and 21, essentially the reporting requirements our immediate effective dates and the things that require more time for us to get wrapped up for the consortium, the reading by nine language and so forth is an effective date of a year out, July 1st, 2020. In conclusion, then, some things that are missing from the bill that were talked about, just for the record, that maybe will come up again was calculating the ADM, the average daily membership for students. That was something that was discussed, whereas we currently have a 20-day window in October that we take a snapshot of student population and we use that to drive a school district, school's funding through the foundation formula. There was the notion of changing that to have a second snapshot done, say, in February for a 20-day period and average those out, or even since we know, and this might cause a flat, I'm expecting some comments from this from the department or the districts, but as a parent, I know that schools take attendance every single day. And they know what their attendance is on any given day, and that theoretically, at least, we could have a year-round average. But by doing that, essentially, we put a crack in the foundation formula, and it would really bulk up the bill because it's referred to a lot in that section of statute. And so because of that, at this time, we backed off of that because it may not be timely to try to crack open the foundation formula. It could easily lead to that. So just FYI for the committee's information. Also, there was a note as regards the consortium, the database. There was an interest expressed that's noteworthy to include teachers being able to access lesson plans and downloading those on a universal level. So sharing and making lesson plans like that open source seems like a reasonable policy for the committee to consider. That concludes the sectional and the overall summary of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Tim. Any comments, any thoughts at this point? Certainly that attendance issue is one that's always been a problem, and maybe there are some ways that we can look at that. So this is, we're not going to be here at a lengthy meeting, but and I don't have a public hearing scheduled, but I do notice we have some folks online, and we have folks in the building and in the room here. Is there anyone care to speak to us at this point as we launch off into the summertime to figure out where we're going? Paul, Dr. Layer is on the line, the Vice President of Student and Research, the University. Dr. Layer, any thoughts you want to share with us?
Hello, Senator Stevens. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, clearly.
Yes. For the record, this is Paul Layer. I'm Vice President for Academic Students and Research at the University of Alaska. You know, the parts of the bill that were Senate Bill 30 and 53, I've testified previously on those, and we've offered some small changes to the language in those. There is still a few things that we have some concerns about regarding some of the reporting that is in Section 6, Number 4, in terms of what the State Board will report and what will be asked of the university. But for the most part, the language is as we've discussed in the previous, and so I don't have any other testimony to offer at this time, but I would be happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Layer. Appreciate your being here. I don't see any questions, but we will be spending more time on this during the interim, and appreciate your involvement at that point. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any comments from anybody in the audience? I see no one's jumping up, so apparently not. And unless there's further comments from members. Yes, please, Senator Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you able to share with the public and those here today in the committee your idea for the interim work? Is it going to be publicly noticed meetings, and is it open to anybody who wants to participate? Are there going to be named participants, or you know, what's your sense about how this works as we move forward?
Well, thank you, Senator. We're just formulating that in the last couple of days, so it may not be exactly firm, but I would suspect we'll have our meetings in Anchorage at the LIO, accessible for most members of our committees, meeting with the House as well, and the chairman have indicated a great interest in working with us on this during the interim. Whether we actually start with Senate Bill 114, which is our bill, and I'm not sure if the House is going to buy into that, but we'll work out those details. And there will be public meetings, public hearings. Everyone will have a chance to testify to us, and we've got lots of people we want to hear from. We made it just through our discussion today. We have several areas that we need to have more information on. So that's the plan, Senator.
Great, thank you.
And we'll formulate that over the next few weeks and try to establish a schedule to meet. And I know it's always going to be difficult with we have five members of our committee. House has seven members of their committee, so it's going to be hard. We'll just have to establish arbitrarily what those meeting times are, and if folks can't make any of those, we'll catch them up as well. Any further comments? Thank you very much, then. We are adjourned at 9:45.